Good evening, and welcome to They Came From the North, your irregularly scheduled dose of pan-Canadian film ramblings. I'm your host for the evening, Andrew Forbes. Joining me are three men from across this morbidly obese continent. From the windswept province of Newfoundland, we have John Mercer.
Hello.
And Steve Power.
I must have a Merlin!
Nay means nay, Uther.
From Boston, Massachusetts, thoroughly fucking up our nationalist theme, we have Michael McVeigh.
We're going to be talking about large stone floating heads tonight.
Penis is bad.
Yankee.
And we would have Gabe usually, but he's a fucking traitor, so.
You bastard.
He's not here. Tonight, we canoe through the murky waters of rural Georgia, only to be stripped and anally humiliated by the gap-toothed filmography of celebrated British director John Borman.
My soul's prepared.
He was born at Shepperton on January 18, 1933. He attended the Salesian School in Surrey, despite his not coming from a Catholic family. As a child, he lived through the Blitz in London, and that would later inform the semi-autobiographical film Hope and Glory. During the late 1950s, Borman worked as a journalist. He ran newsrooms in Southampton and Dover, eventually making his way into television documentary filmmaking in the early 1960s. Borman's first chance to direct a feature film came in 1965 with Catch Us If You Can, a wacky musical comedy featuring the Dave Clark Five designed to ride the wake of Richard Lester's Beatles films. Although the film wasn't as successful as A Hard Day's Night, it received positive notices and was successful enough to bring Borman to the attention of American film studios. In 1967, Lee Marvin requested Borman for the job of directing Point Blank, an intense, stylish, and structurally inventive adaptation of The Hunter by Richard Stark, a.k.a. Donald Westlake. The film was heavily inspired by the French New Wave and was well-received by critics, since grown considerably in reputation. The following year, Borman re-teamed with Marvin and doubled down on international machismo, bringing in Toshiro Mifune to co-star for the World War II drama Hell in the Pacific. It's an unconventional war film that reduces the Pacific theater to a tale of brute survival as Marvin's American soldier is marooned on an island with his Japanese counterpart. 1970's Leo the Last is largely forgotten, but it earned Borman the Best Director Award at the Cannes Film Festival. It's heavily inspired by the work of Fellini, going so far as to star Fellini regular Marcello Mastroianni. But it was 1974's Deliverance that pushed Borman into the realm of celebrated auteur. James Dickey's source novel was widely hailed, but the film adaptation made the work iconic in the minds of moviegoers around the world. As with Hell in the Pacific, Borman crafted a lean tale of men brought up against their animalistic selves as they must contend with the brutality of nature and their own species. While the film's most famous scene has been thoroughly mined for comic effect, it remains utterly compelling. Now seen as a big-time bankable talent, Borman began developing a hugely ambitious adaptation of The Lord of the Rings. The production proved too costly, however, and the project was abandoned, although Borman had corresponded with Tolkien during his preparations for the film.
No kidding.
In 1973, Borman directed undoubtedly his most bizarre film, Zardoz. It featured a post-Bond Sean Connery in a red thong and ponytail, and with strange touches such as a giant stone head telling its idolaters that, as mentioned earlier, the penis is evil, the gun is good. The reviews were mixed, with some critics lauding the production, but noting the excess of an apparent vanity project. In 1977, Borman helmed Exorcist II, The Heretic. It was a hugely expensive production, but was thoroughly panned by critics and audiences. It's a film so bad that Paul Hindread, of all people, retired from trying to act. Also, I'm pretty sure Richard Burton didn't drink before Exorcist II.
That was
1981 finished. Saw the release of Excalibur, a visually spectacular telling of the Arthur legend. Borman used some of his ideas from the aborted Lord of the Rings adaptation and drew heavily from Sir Thomas Malory's Le Meurtre d'Arthur. I think I pronounced that properly. I used to speak French, I should know. Though some critics complained that the film was a structural mess, it featured sequences of really powerful dreamlike intensity. Anyway, here's the part where I ran out of time. So after 1981, he directed The Emerald Forest, Hope and Glory, The Tailor of Panama, and some other shit.
Beyond Rangoon!
Beyond Rangoon! Yeah. Also, he was going to take up David Lean's production of Nostromo when David Lean died, but then didn't. Now it's time to dig into the good, the bad, and the ugly of John Borman. Which films shoot to thrill like a muscular Burt Reynolds, and which cause us to squeal like Ned Beatty in his underoos? Steve? What's your good? We'll start with you.
I narrowed it down to three. I really want
to narrow it down to one.
I have one. I do have one that I had to settle on, but as you said earlier, I wanted to go Excalibur. Every fiber of my being wanted to go Excalibur because that is probably my favorite John Borman movie. But in all good conscience, I just couldn't. I also have a really big soft spot for Beyond Rangoon. I saw it originally in the VHS days, like when it first came out. I've seen it maybe five or six times since then. And it's one of those films, it's like the year of Living Dangerously. It's one of those, you know, Stranger in a Strange Land movies where you really kind of see a corner of the world that they don't show very often in, you know, big theatrical films. And on top of that, it had a really nice epic feel to it. But ultimately, I did have to settle on Deliverance. Deliverance is one of those movies, you know, it's been parodied so much, it's been made fun of, it's kind of, you know, it's been boiled down to those essence, like the stereotypical essence of the movie, so much by popular culture that, you know, people don't think of it as the top serious thriller that it was in, 1972?
Even knowing that, when you go back to it, it holds up as that.
And that's just it. Like, when you go back and you watch that movie, like, man, that is one lean picture. And man, that is one well-acted picture. Like, Reynolds is fantastic. Beatty's fantastic. Everybody, like, the entire cast is...
And it was Beatty's first movie.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean...
Also Ronnie Cox's first movie.
Yeah, and
before he just sort of started coasting as evil executive or country singer.
But it was just there's something about that movie, man. And I mean, I went back to it only recently. I picked it up on Blu-ray. I picked up the picture book edition or whatever it is, the digibook or whatever they call them. And man, it is a beautiful movie. It's stunningly well shot, which is something that, like, that's kind of a Borman thing anyway. The guy, you know, the only other filmmaker I've seen with a similar eye to him would probably be Kubrick. You know, he's got that slowness to it, like that methodical pace. Maybe even Terrence Malick, I guess, but not quite as ridiculous as Malick. But, you know, Deliverance is just a beautiful-looking movie. You sit down and watch it. It's got a sparseness to it that, you know, it's different. It separates it from Kubrick or Malick, but it's just got this visual style that, like, it's a great movie to just look at. You know, it's dark.
I find it so... When you mentioned Kubrick and Malick,
yeah,
that suddenly made, like, perfect sense to me. It's like that sort of being immersed in nature from Malick.
Yeah.
And then this kind of
surreal,
crazy, almost sort of on the edge of comic,
yeah,
sort of sexual threat that you get from Kubrick, like
exactly.
A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, it's just, it's, and it combines kind of both of their sensibilities, but at the same time, it feels totally unique. Like, you can't really, you know, you can't sit down and look at Deliverance and say, oh, hey, it feels like a Kubrick film or it feels like a Malick film. It feels like, you know, if Kubrick and Malick had a love child with Walter Hill, maybe, and I don't know, you know, it's this bizarre, it has its own feel, it really has its own unique feel, and I find...
Oh, man, now I want to think of it with a Ry Cooter score.
and I mean, like, all of Borman's stuff is something, like, you know, when I went back and rediscovered, all of his stuff really does have a unique feel to it, but Deliverance is just, man, there is something about the execution on that movie, you know?
I'm going to jump in here, even though I would usually go last, because Deliverance is also my good. And just to copy you completely, with Excalibur, it's like, I would say Excalibur is definitely my favorite, but it doesn't hold together well enough, to really, to say that it's Borman's best.
There's a lot of craziness in that movie, man.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of falls apart as a story at certain parts.
Yeah.
Yeah, Deliverance is just incredibly, like, every moment of it is just taut.
Yeah.
And Reynolds is, like, amazing. Like, a lot of people sort of mock Reynolds for not really trying and not really being a serious actor, but he's terrific in this. Yeah. I think it's the best work I've seen from him, certainly.
It was early Hungry Reynolds, you know, it was pre-Superstar Reynolds.
Yeah, before he sort of, you know, bought into his own hype, I suspect.
I think it's just, you know, he found a shtick that worked and that made him popular, yeah. And he stuck with that, you know?
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I would say it's a movie that almost has no missteps. The only thing I can really find wrong with Deliverance is just a kind of wonky day for night sort of weird filming style during the cliff climbing sequence.
Yeah, yeah.
That gets a little weird, and that sort of dates it. But beyond that, I mean, despite the fact that it's obviously sort of a particular time, it doesn't feel like it still feels as exciting as a contemporary thriller. I was just going to say, like, the thing I always forget when I watch it is that there's a mini sort of a mini thriller at the end that's almost separate from the rest of it when certain characters who come out of the canoeing trip come up against law enforcement and they have to get their story straight, and there's some concern about, you know, what if they're discovered, and it feels like this sort of extra sort of ratcheting down of the screws on top of everything else they've gone through.
Oh, I thought that was amazing, actually. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not. And James Dickey, the author, plays the sheriff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just concerned with, you know, the what happens to man in the wild. You know, like, it's concerned about the consequences of that.
Mm-hmm. It also has one of the greatest taglines of all time.
This is the weekend they didn't go
they
fishing.
They didn't play golf.
Or they didn't play golf. My thing with it, my biggest thing with Deliverance is, you know, in spite of all the, you know, you see so many movies that get boiled down by popular culture, you know, like they become a meme or they become a, you know, just a thing that everybody knows, and it gets boiled down to its essence, and, you know, it loses some of that potency. What's that?
Fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Like, I mean, Silence of the Lambs, now you could almost watch it as an unintentional comedy, you know, like it puts the lotion on its skin. It's like, ah, ha, 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 you know,
yeah.
But
that wasn't a Lecter line, man.
No, I know. But I'm just saying, you know, but it's one of those things where Deliverance still, like, in spite of all of the parodies and all the satire and just how, like, you know, squeal little piggy or whatever, you know, like,
it's almost sort of become, I mean, it's gone beyond simply talking about Deliverance. You know, people just talk about hillbillies.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, they don't even realize that this is where it all came from. Like, Deliverance is still, you know, it's still a lean, mean movie, man. It's still an entertaining film that can just be enjoyed on its own merits without any irony. You know, like, you don't get that feeling of irony when you watch it, because the movie does such a great job of pulling you into that world when you turn it on. You know, like, it does it's such an immersive film.
Agreed. All right, so
it's also very dark, or very bleak.
Oh, wait, is it ever?
And I personally love that the four heroes at no point in the movie ever do anything remotely heroic. You've got Reynolds' rescue sequence in it, but I mean, they're all so completely out of their element.
Yeah. Also, how the fuck did they get Ronnie Cox's arm to do that?
He's double jointed.
That's beyond double jointed.
I read an interview they did with, on the 40th anniversary of Deliverance. That's a reporter. They did a screening. He sat down with all four of the main leads, and they're all making fun of how Ronnie Cox can't do that anymore. It's like, why are you guys making fun of him for being old? You're all as fucking old as he is.
There's a great documentary, actually, on the Blu-ray. It's all filmed at the Burroughs Museum, but it's the four principal characters all sat down talking about the movie. And it's actually a really great little interview.
I love when they make fun of James Dickey, too. Because he had he went on this big ego trip and had all this dialogue written for his sheriff character. So Borman shot all that dialogue over with him talking to another character over by a car, and then moved him over to do the shot he was going to keep in the movie, and then just cut everything else out.
Well played, Borman.
Isn't it the Coens who, you know, they let their actors improv, they set up the shot, they say action and all of that, but they got a secret little signal that they give to their cameraman, so their cameramen are not actually recording.
Okay, moving on. Mike, what's your good?
Well, I was thinking about Deliverance. It's a movie that I've seen when I was younger and really loved that movie. I own it, in fact.
And made you the man you are today.
Yeah, well, I didn't rewatch it for this podcast because I had seen it a bunch of times and went dive bombing for it on my shelf when you guys are talking about it. I'm looking at a shotgun coming out of a lake right here. And, you know, I liked that movie quite a bit, and I would consider that, you know, probably one of his best films, if not his best film. I also love Excalibur to no end. That actually, I'm sure I'll chime in on whoever is going to talk about Excalibur.
We'll be talking about it.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
But a movie that I had not seen up until just a couple of weeks ago was Point Blank. And I thought that movie rocked.
God damn it. That was my good.
yeah, it's Borman using every trick in the book, you know, this movie. It's, you know,
it's, it's so brutal.
Yeah. It's
but also
it's,
just like incredibly sort of, I don't want to say necessarily inventive, because I think he was taking a lot from the French New Wave, but structurally, he throws a whole bunch of tricks in there.
Yeah, that non-linear storytelling and flashbacks. That
It really adds to the sort of fatalistic feeling of it.
I think it was kind of the world's first neo-noir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Where you kind of had that, you know, that car crash between French New Wave and film noir.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I sorry, Mike, I'm going to jump in and get all my points out of the way now. Because Point Blank's also my good. Now, critics used to love painting it as the perfect thriller, and I got to say, I'm inclined to agree with that. I love the look of the movie kind of mirrors the whole thing, everything that's going on with Walker in it. You've got the instead of gritty old city streets, you've got the glistening LA skyscrapers, and that goes hand in hand with the instead of the. The two-bit hoods like Walker, you've got this new corporate crime syndicate. Yeah. And I love the way Borman makes L.A. just look – it looks like an alien planet. Right? It's – the city is terrifying, but not nearly as terrifying as Lee Marvin.
Point Blank is a freaking awesome movie, man. Like, if there is a film today that could still be considered the epitome of gritty city 70s filmmaking, it is probably Point Blank.
And it didn't even come out in the 70s.
Yeah. About 69, wasn't it? Or
67. But, I mean, you can definitely draw a line from this to Dirty Harry. Even though, there are a lot of differences. I mean, it's clearly not about the same kind of character. I think something came out of this that... that went into those movies.
I love, you know, Walker is completely smash and grab, and he's really, it's, you always hear the cliche, you know, a character, they're less of a man and more of a force of nature. But people think of that and they automatically think of Hurricane. Walker's not a hurricane. He's a glacier of violence. He just moves. Yeah, it was methodically across the city, killing everything in his path.
He is a continental shift.
He doesn't even utter a noise until 20 minutes into the movie. Right? Lee Marvin is the monster that all of our dragons look under the bed for, and he's the fucking god of thunder that every action hero wants to be when they grow up. And I went back and I rewatched it. I've never, ever, I know it's out, but I've never seen a copy of Point Blank on DVD or Blu-ray.
I have.
So I just downloaded
it. I'm pretty sure you still get it at HMV.
You've been saying that to me for 10 years, and I've yet to see a copy.
I know the cover is like the old 50s or the old 60s style movie poster. It's the original poster cover kind of thing.
Yeah,
I got my copy at the library.
It's I kind of like, you know, because Borman. It was a very different visual style when the movie came out, and you know. I used to knock it a little – actually, not knock it because I've always loved Point Blank. Knock that era of filmmaking entirely, because you get these big wide shots where there's only two characters and they're both on the opposite side of the frame.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very – I always make fun of Bullet the same way. It's – you know,
I was just going to bring Bullet up.
It's a big populated city, but there's hardly anyone in it.
And there's elements sort of in of the way that it presents the environment and these new kinds of criminals that I've like really feels like Point Blank to me.
But I think the thing with Bullet, though, the difference between Point Blank and Bullet, and maybe it's the Guinness talking, but Point Blank is awesome and Bullet kind of sucks.
Yeah.
my difference between the two of them is Point Blank is a it's a wild ride that isn't looking to be a trip. You know, it's a ferociously sexy movie that isn't burdened with the need to be cool, which elevates it above stuff like even favorites of mine like Bullet and Vanishing Point.
I don't know. I disagree with that sentiment. I think the movie endeavors to be cool. In fact, I think coolness is its, like, primary motive, you know.
I'm not sure that cool was really a thing that Borman – like, I think it was – I think
you're
going to
be cool off the just the ice that's blowing off of Lee Mervin.
Does it have a ska soundtrack?
His hair is like ice. Apparently, he went gray fairly early. I wasn't sure how. What
was the hate burned all the color out of him. This
he is. He was born in 1924, and you know he. The movie was made in 67, so that would make him what, early mid 40s, 42, 43, something like that when the movie came out. And he had gray hair all over, and he was in great shape too. You know, he's got his shirt off in a couple scenes, knocking guys out and whatnot. We're just walking.
Maybe John Byrne.
I remember the very first time I ever saw a trailer for Point Blank was Steve. Do you remember First Choice?
Yep.
That old movie station.
Oh yeah, hell yeah.
Forbes, you familiar with First Choice?
Not sure.
I don't know if you guys got. You guys would have got.
It became TMN.
Okay.
But First Choice used to run classic movies as well as. What were modern movies in the late 80s, early 90s. And I remember seeing the trailer for Point Blank and leaning over and asking Dad why the guy from Mission Impossible was was being so mean. I mean, like,
oh, is he mean in this movie?
Well, I mean, man, Lee Mervin slapped John Vernon so hard that he made him cry in real life. And then right after that in the movie, he pitches him out a fucking window.
Yeah. I remember one of the things I remember most about when I first watched Point Blank is John Vernon's performance. The first time I watched it, I thought it was bad acting. And when I came back to it
it's terrific acting.
It's terrific. It's sort of manic
and I think this
energy
is
that you need in that character.
He's perfectly sleazy. He's a bloodthirsty psychopath.
And it's kind of hard. I was going back and reading reviews of this, and you know, every it seems like every single review on the internet can't do a good review of Point Blank without slagging on Payback. And you know, I'm not going to knock Payback. I love the what's it called, the straight up cut. I love the director's cut of Payback.
I love both cuts of Payback.
Yeah, it's just it's not the same movie as Point Blank.
Well, it's a Mel Gibson.
No. It's a testament to how. What a good source story it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, how many times have they remade The Hunter?
Well, I can tell you that Parker absolutely fucking sucked.
I wouldn't watch it.
It was garbage. I turned it off.
But how many times? The acclaimed director of Ray.
Now, how many times? This has got to be one of the earliest times I've seen the LA River in a movie.
Oh, the aqueduct.
Yeah, in Los Angeles, the LA River. You see it in a bunch of movies like Grease and Drive and like Terminator 2 and
Repo Man.
Yeah,
Italian Job.
To Live and Die LA.
The new Italian Job, not the old Italian Job.
I like Point Blank for, you know, hot Angie Dickinson, you know.
There is that.
Carol O'Connor's like chewing a lot of scenery and is like little.
Thank
bit,
you for bringing up Carol O'Connor.
Yeah.
He is kind of a kind of a, he's definitely chewing on some scenery in this movie.
It's great though to watch Carol O'Connor in this and Carol O'Connor in Kelly's Heroes, and it's like it's the they're both at the same level of performance, but like in one he's just hysterical, and in the other he's like genuinely menacing.
You also have that Peter Haim, the Peter Himes guy, Peter, what's his name? James Seeking. Remember that guy? He just popped up in all the Himes movies. He plays another hitman.
Holy shit, that's him? Oh my God.
Yeah, he's always playing these like super shady government sniper killer types. And
I never made that connection.
Yeah, so he pops up in this movie, you know, amidst all the 60s design sensibility.
But you can't shoot Lee Marvin.
Footsteps were pretty echoey there during that hallway march, that big buildup. You remember that?
I do.
And then what does he do at the end of it? He just bursts through the door and just like grabs a girl and just is ready to just like kill anybody. It's quite a payoff to, I think, like 17 minutes of just steps in my ears. I like in the costume design how like Angie Dickinson's costume kind of matches the room a lot. There's like some interesting color stuff going on. You know, like there's red rooms with like red outfits and green rooms. And,
I love that jazz club.
He had a design for the film's look, you know. Like, there's a lot of grays and cool kind of grays when it comes to Lee Marvin's character, you know. And I thought that was one of the more interesting, you know. And then the film gets really colorful when they go to, like, funky faux James Brown's underground go-go club for old white men.
I always get confused at the end of, but when I sort of remember back to Point Blank, I always mix it up with that version of The Killers with Lee Marvin, with Ronald Reagan slapping Angie Dickinson. So in my head, there's this sort of weird world where Lee Marvin is just walking around shooting people, and Ronald Reagan shows up and slaps Angie Dickinson around. And then Archie Bunker's like, fuck all y'all.
You just reminded me, Forbes, this is another one that had a great tagline on the poster.
Oh, wait. Was it, if you ever want to see a naked John Vernon plummet off a building, this is your movie.
You will believe naked John Vernon can fly. No, I think it was, in his world, there's two kinds of people, his victims and his women, and sometimes you can't tell the difference.
Oh.
Wow. Feminist groups must have loved this movie.
Okay, I think we should.
You think
move on.
Lee Marvin gives a shit about feminists?
Feminazis.
Yeah, but John Borman does.
Yeah, really.
Temporarily disassociating myself from where this is going.
We should move on. We should move on to the bads.
All right, the bads. Let's go in the same order. Steve, what's your bad?
My bad is going to be Excalibur. Why is
Yes, I'm jumping right in there with you.
Yeah, Excalibur is a goddamn amazing movie. Anybody who disagrees with me obviously has no idea what they're talking about or have never seen Excalibur. Holy shit. Where to even begin with Excalibur, really?
If you want to see Captain Picard straining to take a shit while grasping a sword, this is the movie for you.
I still love, no, his line delivery of against you is amazing.
What I love is it's Captain Picard as if all the seasons of Star Trek were all when he yells the speech about the Borg from First Contact.
Man, I couldn't.
No!
I also like that the husband from Keeping Up Appearances is the adopted dad of Arthur. And basically, once Arthur leaves, that's when his life goes to shit.
He pretty much disappears from the movie at that point.
Yeah.
The brother shows up a few times, but now the dad is kind of gone. But yeah, man, that movie, I think it's an amazing, like, embracing, I guess, of the Arthurian myth and how it tells the tale, like how it tells the Arthurian saga. I know Le Morte d'Arthur wasn't exactly, like, it was kind of considered like a new wave, hippy-drippy retelling, apparently, of the whole legend. But I think Borman, the way he delivers it, man, he makes it feel like, you know, like Beowulf. He makes it feel like this is adapted from some What's that?
Yeah. Right from the get-go. As soon as, like, even before you see a single frame of that movie,
yeah,
you know, like,
yeah.
You all of a sudden the Wagner comes on and it's like that score and it's just that dark tone and and then the credits of the sparkling Excalibur title.
Yeah.
I was so obsessed with that as a kid when I used to make my own videos at home. I had a school project I did on Rome and like I was making a video for it and I took like construction paper and cut out the name Rome and then built a fire in my fireplace and then put it over so the flames would be in the background like a stencil and filmed that and then like backtracked and then just dropped in the same exact music from Excalibur and made it the same exact title. That's how much I loved it. And then it rolls right into like those knights just silhouetted against this fiery night sky,
yeah,
full of like steam and gloom and just brutal axes to the chest and like just lanky heaviness of it.
Andrew,
that's the thing is I remember reading criticisms and hearing criticisms from people about the fighting in the movie. Like it looked, they were like, oh, it's like Monty Python.
No.
And it's like, no, these guys are wearing a lot of weight, and it's really hard to fight in mud.
And it's also, you know, like, well, I will go back. I got to backtrack, sorry. Andrew just pointed out to me I'm mistaking Le Morte d'Arthur with The Once and Future King, which was the one that was written in the 60s, and the guy was
Freaky Deaky.
The guy who wrote The Once and Future Once and Future King co-wrote Excalibur, like he's got screenplay credit or whatever on Excalibur. I think it's the same one. Either way, that's the story that was considered, you know, hippy-drippy, the one that this guy co-wrote. But yeah, like, the fight scenes and stuff, yeah, they do feel a little stilted. They do feel a little, realistic, maybe, is the word I'd use. They don't feel polished at all, you know? Like, they feel like, yeah, these guys are wearing about 80 pounds of armor and hacking at each other with swords, you know?
Yeah, it's brutal.
It is. It's pretty savage. And like, I've seen, you know, of course, obviously, I haven't seen real medieval combat because none of us have invented time travel yet. But I've seen, you
and,
know.
And in fairness, the armor is anachronistic.
It's, yeah. Oh, big time. Big time. But, you know, I've seen enough reenactments and stuff to know that it's not as pretty as movies like Braveheart even make it out to be, you know?
Yeah.
It's not as poetic and graceful as, you know, The Lord of the Rings.
One thing I wanted to say about Excalibur, because it's also my bad, is, again, I mean, aside from the fact it's only not my good because of some sort of structural issues and the fact
and,
that sort of
as a
continuing story.
Are you still there, Mr. Forbes? I think
yeah, he'll be talking. He went offline, I'm sure, but he'll be talking for the next 15 minutes. He won't notice. So anyway, Excalibur.
Parts of it have lived in nightmares.
Oh, here we go. Yeah, we lost you for a second, Andrew.
What was that? Can you repeat the last 18 minutes of that?
Making some very compelling points about how awesome Excalibur is, but I mean everything about it, the musical choices, it's a combination of pre-existing selections and some score by Trevor Jones.
Yeah.
Just there are parts that the effects, you know, feel these days sort of, I mean, they're more obvious camera tricks or, you know, you look at some elements of some set design and say, okay, that could have been a little more polished. But overall, it's just got such a tremendous overall atmosphere.
It's got so much texture.
Yeah.
The movie has much texture.
That opening where you have, to mitigate some of my criticisms about the structure, it's definitely pitched from the very first frame as myth.
Yeah.
Right? It's, you know, it, you've got that title that's punctuated by those notes. And then the main title comes up. You're thrown right into this violence, and then this silhouetted figure backlit in sort of fire and blood is Merlin comes over the hill.
And goddamn, does he ever look badass in that sequence. Yeah. When you see that, those tattered robes,
mm-hmm.
man, it looks amazing. And
how do you say Nicole Williamson?
Nicole Williamson.
Is an absolute fantastic actor, you know, mm-hmm. and his entire career, past and future, wiped out by that performance.
Because it was phenomenal. It was absolutely phenomenal. People, like, I've seen a few people shit on Merlin in this movie, and I immediately jump on the defensive as like, my God, man, how can you attack that performance?
You have this character who is essentially immortal.
Yeah.
And sort of his life is about sort of having to deal with these stupid people who are just driven by their crotches.
Yeah.
And he's trying to sort of make this continuous line of nation building, and you'd go a bit nuts. So it's absolutely perfect for it.
And he manages
to walk that line of sort of comedy and sort of a threatening quality.
That first encounter with Lancelot, you know, when Arthur is up there on the bridge and there's all this deadly shenanigans going on between Arthur and Lancelot, and he's down in a river trying to catch a fish.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's almost sort of childlike. Like, he's had so much time to sort of learn about this place that, in a sense, he's almost disconnected from these very simple things that people take for granted in life. And he's like, oh, a fish. This is interesting.
This is beautiful. You know? But yeah, no, I just, all the performances really too, like Arthur, I thought was fantastic, except for young Arthur.
Mm-hmm. Young Arthur, yeah. I mean, that's bad, sort of the one part that's not terribly convincing in terms of acting.
Here, Kay, I lost your sword, but I found Excalibur.
Oh, I guess I'll be king.
Okay.
All right. All right. Very good.
Can we talk about Helen Mirren?
Oh, we can talk about Helen Mirren.
Anal Nathrach.
Oh, delicious. Careful, it could harm your beauty. Oh, that man, like, performances were great. Costume design, Bob Ringwood, absolutely phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
The production.
Are we gonna get to this being a bad, like?
Yeah. Give me a second. I'm getting there. Costume design phenomenal. That final act, man. Like when Arthur gets back on the horse and all hell breaks loose. Fucking amazing. But then there's that whole middle act with the Grail Quest, where the movie just completely flounders.
Yeah.
When it's just Percival walking around looking stoned.
And Lancelot in the role of Dolph Lundgren and Johnny Mnemonic. Halt, sinners!
Arthur! But that, and he shows up at the end just long enough to basically die.
Although I will say that sequence does contain sort of when we finally break out of that really draggy period.
Yeah.
It's sort of poetic in the way that the time when we really break out of it is when, what's his face? You just mentioned his name, Percival? Who's wandering around. Yeah.
Yeah.
When he falls into the river.
Yeah.
And sort of pulls off his armor in slow motion, and you have the building music, and he sort of comes out of this river, shed of all this baggage, right? And that's the moment when the movie once again sort of kicks in.
But I never ever got the whole, the surrealistic, you know, the Grail part of the movie. It's like, you know, he's out, he's looking.
It's a different mode of storytelling.
Yeah, it's very much a surreal kind of nightmarish vision or something. And it's not, like the movie plays it more or less narratively straight up to that point. Like, it might as well be Braveheart up to that point. And then it just goes off into fucking acid land.
But on repeat viewings, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, again, this is why it's a bad. It's certainly not an ugly, but...
No.
I mean, yes, that's a flaw. But having said that, when I go back and watch it again...
Oh, it's amazing.
Those qualities don't don't bother me this, you know, the first couple times I watched it, I'd be like, what is going on? Yeah. Why are we doing this? And now when I watch it, I'm sort of just sucked into the whole, the vibe of, I watch it almost like I watched 2001.
Yeah.
Or, you know, listen to a symphony.
And that's a pretty apt comparison, actually, 2001, because it does kind of, you know, it's transformative in that it takes you to this other time and this other place that's not real. But, like, the way it does go into the surreal and stuff like that, like the whole, and even to a little bit of an extent, you get a little bit of the existentialism with the whole, you know, like, what is the secret of the Grail? You and the land are one, and yada, 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 you know? Like, it's just kind of like, it does get a little bit, you know, is he God?
But at the same time, I mean, that sort of cuts to the heart of why it's an enduring legend.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that the nation is embodied in this person.
Exactly, exactly. You know, and like
he's embodied in this sword.
Well, I mean, I think that the real reason why Excalibur is what did you say just now, is a legend, or what was that phrase that you just?
Let's call it mythic fable.
Yeah, I think that it has a place as a mythic fable for at least my generation, because it happened to come out on VHS and home video, and for a lot of kids that were, I don't know, I guess born in the or of viewing age in the 80s, going into the 90s, that was an early exposure to a sex scene that happened at the
in full armor
beginning of the in the beginning of the movie, that really kind of, I think, skews some people
starring in the naked body of the director's daughter.
Yes.
As to what is really comfortable for a woman during lovemaking.
Or what
suit of armor
for a film crew.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw Excalibur. I was fairly young the first time I saw Excalibur, because, you know, I grew up in, I came of age, we'll say, in the mid-80s. So it's kind of one of those things that, like, people don't realize how fucking huge Dungeons & Dragons was in the mid-80s, okay? And anything that had swords on the cover.
Anyone who's followed the career of Tom Hanks knows exactly how serious it was.
But, you know, anything that had a knight or swords and stuff on the cover at a video store was going home in the bag at the end of the browsing of the rental shelf.
And Excalibur had both on the cover.
Oh, it did. Did it ever. I mean, like, movies like Excalibur and Legend and, like, all of that stuff, you know, Deathstalker and all of this stuff. I mean, because it had guys with swords. Okay, it's like, we got to watch it. And Excalibur, I still remember the very first time I ever saw Excalibur was an old Betamax copy that was rented from Alan's Video in Mount Pearl. And myself and Dad sat down and watched it, and I might have been, I'd say if I was 10 or 11, that's all I was, and man, the movie blew my mind. I was just like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life, and I believe it was 2 or 3 days later I showed it to my buddy Kevin Woolridge. I was like, you have got to see this movie, and we sat down and we watched it, and I mean, in the span of about a week, there were probably 6 or 7 of us all had sat down and watched Excalibur, and all of us freaking loved it. You know, like,
of you said the same thing. Liam Neeson's in this?
Well, we didn't. We had no idea who Liam Neeson was at that point.
I will say, Liam Neeson gives the worst performance in this movie, probably.
worse
was
than
drunk
Krull?
On Helen Mirren.
Worse than Krull, really?
I haven't seen Krull.
Oh my God. You need to see Krull.
When the Peter Yates episode comes along, definitely going to be watching it. Can we give a brief shout out to the fucking amazing Bob Peake poster?
Oh my God, yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely. It's the VHS cover as well.
It was, yeah. It was the Beta and VHS cover. Sadly, it is not the DVD or Blu-ray cover. The DVD cover was absolutely atrocious.
Yeah.
The Blu-ray cover is the same artwork, but they got rid of the really obnoxious yellow. And they kind of monochromed it a little bit, so it looks a little bit classier, but man, that old theater.
I just can't figure out. It's like, clearly the people who want to own Excalibur would love that artwork.
Yeah, exactly. One of the copies of it I had, I think it might have been the VHS copy, actually came with a postcard of that cover.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. It was pretty cool. I got to say, too, the Blu-ray looks stunning. It's a really, really nice transfer.
Does anybody remember just how freakish Mordred's mask looks?
Yep.
I was just going to say,
it's like he's wearing box art for Caligula on his face.
When Mike was talking about sort of like it being a formative movie for people of our generation, Like, I just think the thing that stuck in my head, I would have nightmares about this freaky fucking kid with this crazy mask.
Yeah, that's the one suit of armor in the movie, too, that looks fake, which kind of sucks.
Mordred.
Yeah, Mordred. And it's kind of a drag because when Mordred does grow up, he becomes a pretty menacing character for like all 5 minutes.
Yeah, before Arthur fucks him up royally.
Well, they fuck each other up, to be fair.
Yeah, but that's a great movie death.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah, it takes place on the set of Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula.
I also love
and he pulls the Helen Mirren's pulling him along the
spear,
yeah.
I also love Helen Mirren's "Death is Worthy of an Indiana Jones Movie."
Oh man, it's just such
a—it's
such a great game or such a great movie. Sorry, but like, just that surreal, weird Grail bit. That's what derails it from being, you know, the greatest movie ever for all time.
I just wanted to say Helen Mirren's, and like, I feel kind of sad because it's like this old woman who's just lost on a cold day, and she's got this sort of look of, what's going on?
Oh, Mordred, come to the sun, whack! Bob, 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 bob! This is what all sons do to their mothers when it gets old, when they get old.
That soundtrack. What movie uses it better? I mean, it's used everywhere, and it's reinterpreted in other places, like Glory. You know, James Horner reinterpreted that, or however you want to call it.
Best use I've ever heard of Wagner was a bear commercial.
Oh yeah,
and they're pouring the bear up, and the chorus starts to appear behind the bartender.
No, it's got to be Excalibur, man. It has to be. I associate that score with Excalibur now.
I have to say the one image from the movie that sticks in my mind the most, I think the one scene that sticks in my mind visually and just everything. I think the movie really worked the best at the moment when Arthur is knighted.
Yeah,
I thought you were going to say Helen Mirren's mesh top.
you know how I feel about Helen Mirren, so. You know, going back to that, I mean, to have it take place in that water, you know, like to waist deep in water.
That's a beautiful, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the way the guy is like, you know, he pulls the sword and kind of holds it for a second in almost a menacing fashion. And Merlin is like, what's this? Oh, I didn't foresee this. You know, like that scene is fucking badass as all hell.
And just just brilliant staging.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on, because we've talked about Excalibur a lot.
And right now, so.
Okay, John and Mike, were either of you going to make Excalibur your bad? And if not, what are your bads? You can fight it out.
Would you like to go first, Michael?
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't really know what I want to choose as a bad.
Oh, Jesus, he pulled a McVeigh.
Okay, you'd be disappointed if he didn't.
I really wanted to talk about Beyond Rangoon because that's a movie I saw a while ago, but you know, I just can't. I don't feel that it's fresh enough, you know. But I will say that I really love that soundtrack by Hans Zimmer.
Man, I really wanted to go back actually and rewatch Beyond Rangoon, but I can't find a version of it worth watching. Like, I can't find a decent quality.
Yeah.
Copy of that.
The thing that sticks in my mind most about Beyond Rangoon is the newspaper ads in the Halifax Chronicle Herald. Like, I just remember seeing it was sort of like eyes peeking through some fronds
or
something. And
That's the album cover too. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember seeing and I remember it was something like my parents' friends were talking about the movie. Like, it was sort of like big among people my parents' age. They were like, oh, Beyond Rangoon, it's a really good movie.
It was a very classy movie. Like, when it came out, it was one of those, you know, classy films. Kind of like Last of the Mohicans, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those ones, you know, I was of the age where I was...
Something classy. Trans Am.
Yeah. Sorry. You know, it was one of those things where I was of the age where I was just starting to kind of branch out in movies kind of thing, starting to watch, you know, more adult fare, like stuff like The Godfather and Apocalypse Now and all of that kind of stuff. You know, it was that period in the 90s. And I got to say, like, the first time I watched it, it was slow. I found it pretty slow. But man, when I went back to it probably 2 years later, thereabouts, I freaking loved it. I still love that movie. It's been a while since I've seen it. But there's some sequences in that movie, like the attack on the village and stuff like that. It's absolutely amazing, like beautifully done, beautifully mounted, right? It feels it's kind of like Last of the Mohicans in that it really feels like a modern epic. Mm-hmm. You know, it feels like, you know, so many people, like stuff like Braveheart and Gladiator and, you know, Master and Commander and all these. Yes, they got that epic feel to them, but they don't have that classic epic feel to them. They don't have that David Lean quality, you know, but Beyond Rangoon really kind of does. I'm not comparing it to a David Lean movie, but it has that tone, you know, that kind of feel.
Can I just say, I always assume when I'm not really thinking about it, in my subconscious, I assume that Angelina Jolie stars in it.
You can. I'll allow it.
Socially conscious, vaguely movie about someone in the UN, maybe?
The closest comparison to it would be The Year of Living Dangerously. That is the closest comparison I can give to it. It's that kind of movie, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I would love to talk more about it and its politics and you know, the fact that, you know, me and Marm used to be called Burma and all of these things, but, you know, it's a movie that I saw so far back in the past, along with a bunch of Borman's films, for instance. He's done, like, The Emerald Forest. That's a movie I saw.
Awesome movie, actually.
Going to be happy with me.
That's okay.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw Hope and Glory. I saw these movies when I was young. I saw these movies before I was a teenager. And they've left an impression on me, a visceral impression. Like, I can remember a lot of his use of water and color and certain scenes in these movies, even though they're not fresh in my mind, they've really stuck with me, particularly the water setting of Hope and Glory and towards the end of that film. And, you know, it just speaks to if I didn't keep rewatching Excalibur, I'm sure that the Knighting of Arthur scene would also fit in that kind of watery geography. It for whatever reason, it just resonates with me visually. It's such a beautiful way to stage a scene around water using these this reflection, and he likes to get the camera really close to the water too, you know, which is something that I think is, it gives it a, I don't know, maybe you feel like you're floating, or I don't know, it's. But that aspect of his filmmaking is something that I've always really responded to, and regardless of the quality, overall quality of the film, which varies, but those sensibilities, I think, are what I would consider my bad.
And you know, my thing with just touching on The Enchanted Forest again for a sec, because I know Andrew's got something coming.
Or is that it, The Enchanted Forest? Or is it
Emerald Forest.
My thing with that movie is, you know, I look at it the same way I look at something like The Rescue. You remember The Rescue?
Yeah, yes. With Johnny Dane, the guy from Entourage.
Yeah.
Right? Is it Kevin Dillon?
Kevin Dillon, yeah, yeah. But I look at that movie the same way. Like, it's a movie I watched when I was young, and it's a movie I saw a few times when I was young. And then going back to it now, I've almost got that nostalgia of how much I enjoyed it back then. I mean, I know it's trash. I know The Rescue is trash too, but I saw The Rescue in theater twice, you know? So, you know, just something about that movie that endears itself to me.
Beyond Rangoon did not make money though.
I know it was pretty hyped when it came out. There was a fair bit of hype behind it, especially the video release. I remember, like, our local video. I don't think they were Blockbuster yet. I think they might've still been East Coast Video at that point. No, I think they might have been Blockbuster at that point. But either way, they had a great big, like, you know, the top of the shelves. They had, like, three or four full shelves with the big Beyond Rangoon banner across it. And they must have had about 90 or 100 copies of that movie sitting there, you know. Like, there was a big deal made about the video release and stuff. I guess they were thinking, you know, it was going to be a big adult renter or whatever, counter-programming or something. But I remember...
You know, the whole thing about Beyond Rangoon is that it was dealing with a very sensitive...
topic and issue, you know, of this violence that's happening, these anti-government protests and this kind of this population at the hands of the military dictatorship. And, you know, it's something that, you know, maybe isn't going to sit well at the time and place of, what was it, 1995? You know, what escapism was going on there?
Yeah, really, know, really.
That year, you know, as far as like to make it a financially viable film, you know, with a budget. I mean, that Beyond Rangoon is a big feeling movie. It's got a lot of, you know, I mean, it's the money's on the screen. There's a pretty epic
in scope.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just reading the synopsis from The Rescue, and this movie sounds fucking bonkers.
Yeah.
It's good. It is.
Yeah, they go rescue their parents. Like, yeah. Oh,
like the director of The Rescue movies. Has a fucking great name. Bernie Dan Fairfax.
That's not.
Aren't there like name? kids?
I feel like it should be a sequel to Red Dawn.
It was actually a Disney movie, I think, when it came out.
Yeah, it was a Disney movie. It was like, you know, just like kids.
Disney takes you to a magical kingdom called North Korea.
I love too the end of the movie where the kid is up on top of the plane with an Uzi and rips open.
Yeah,
shirt and he's got the Bruce Springsteen.
He does a fist pump or
whatever. Yeah.
Okay. Deviation. John, it's your bad.
Hey, John.
Okay, my bad. We'll be short and sweet with this one. The General from 1998. I enjoyed The General, but I didn't like it. Or would that sound better the other way?
You liked The General, but you didn't enjoy it. Yeah, that's something. Yeah. That makes a bit more sense, I think.
That's the same.
There's a lot to be said about Brendan Gleeson's blustery middle finger to the coppers and the IRA feck the world performance. That about sums up my feelings on it. You guys remember a few episodes ago when we were talking about, I think it was Peter Weir, and I was talking about the Mosquito Coast and how the entire movie was just Harrison Ford?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what The General is.
I don't think I've ever seen The General.
It's Brendan Gleeson playing an Irish criminal.
Okay, I think maybe I have, but I just don't really remember it.
And John Voight plays the cop that's chasing him.
How's his accent?
John Voight's accent is terrible.
I expected no less.
Brendan Gleeson's accent is slurred by whiskey.
And genuine.
But it's better than Pierce Brosnan's Irish accent in his Irish criminal movie from the 80s.
Pierce Brosnan is Irish.
I know, but what was that movie called? Well, maybe you shouldn't be living here.
I don't even know.
It's funny, the worst Irish accent in film history came from an Irishman.
I don't know, man. Arthur's Irish accent in Excalibur was pretty bad.
Now, Gleeson doesn't quite turn in the hurricane that Ford did, but it's a similar sort of deal. He overshadows everything else in the movie, and it really lacks Borman's style. It's really schizophrenic. You know, on one hand, he's trying to play up Cahill as a hero, but on the other hand, the dude's a thug. You know, he's got a little bit of swagger to make you like him, but he's a thick-skulled bully, too. It's just, it's not very enjoyable.
I remember when the movie came out, there was sort of like a lot of, or it seemed that there was a lot of notice about Brendan Gleeson at the time, and he hadn't been,
there's always,
I mean, he'd been in Braveheart, but it seemed like as a known quantity in the U.S. and Canada, he didn't have much of a presence, and I seem to remember that people were sort of taking notice of him in this movie.
There's every time he does anything, though, where he's the lead, there's always going to be... What was the one he did a few years ago where he was the cop or whatever? He was another Irish police officer who had a coke problem or something. And every time Brendan Gleeson does a movie where he's the headliner, it always gains notice. Everybody always does it.
Really fucking good actor.
He is. He's, I mean, he's a great actor. He's
oh, and he is the best part of Kingdom of Heaven.
I love Kingdom of Heaven, so you know, you're
blood soaked beard. Good times.
I wonder how many times they had to reshoot Edward Norton slapping him. He'd be slapping McGleese and be like, harder!
Harder, Edward, you pansy!
I always forget that he's in 28 Days Later.
Yes, yeah, he is.
And he's great in it.
He is. He's the dad, yeah.
All right. Is that all you have to say, John?
Yeah.
Is that all you have to say for yourself?
Maybe you shouldn't be living here.
All right. I
gotta find out what that movie was called.
Let's move on to our uglies. Clearly, bad can mean anything from bad to our favorite movie ever. So, ugly is where we actually talk about things we really, really hate.
Clearly, I'm all insane.
Yeah, I'm actually gonna kick it off.
Go for it.
With The Emerald Forest.
You son of a bitch.
This fucking movie is like, it's all of the worst parts of like the sort of like liberal guilt, liberal cause, environmental sort of movie, like everything from Fern Gully to what have you, and plus major vanity project for John Borman, I suspect. It's incredibly sort of patronizing to certain Amazonian tribes at the same time as really broadly characterizing their enemies as basically the murder tribe. It's got Charlie Borman, who played young Mordred, who is probably the most disturbing looking human who's ever been born. He looks like a ventriloquist dummy. He's lost, it played by another actor, but he's lost as a child, Powers Booth, in the only bad Powers Booth performance I've ever seen, is his father, who is the hero of the movie and also a major engineer for something that's like raping the land, this giant dam that's going to flood tons of acres of rainforest, and then they have to tear down a bunch more. We skip immediately over 10 years with a title card that says, you know, Phil spent 10 years looking for his son. And then, you know, just to jump right into when he goes off to the forest and suddenly finds him again, we have a bit of a diversion with him sort of spraying machine gun fire into the jungle because he's apparently the worst person to ever fire a gun that there's ever been. I mean, I'm the ultimate sort of weak-wristed, artsy, liberal, physical coward.
Your words,
and I know
not
better
mine.
Than he does. You know, there's some mystical bullshit where he becomes the jaguar spirit animal and his eyes turn green. And then randomly, you know, murder tribe comes in and steals a bunch of women and they go work as strippers at, you know, Dino Sleazeball in the jungle's random, like, strip club. And then they rescue them and, you know, shoot slash stab a bunch of drug dealing sleazeballs. Go back into the jungle, and a couple of guys from the city decide that they don't want to be city folks anymore, and they take off their clothes and they become tribespeople again. Then Powers Booth blows up the fucking dam.
Yeah, hell yeah.
With some terrible fucking effects.
It was the right thing to do.
Man, you do a little bit of coke and sit around a fire.
There's no such thing as a little bit of coke.
And suddenly you're like, oh my God, this thing I've devoted my entire life to is evil. And if I just sort of, you know, put some dynamite here.
He went on a vision quest.
And then tell people that I miscalculated and the rain broke the dam. They're going to buy that.
The frog sang loudly enough.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what,
oh my God.
What happens when you drop acid and watch Bridge Over the River Kwai.
It's a terrible, terrible. I mean, it's overly sentimental. It's just
Nick
like
Foster
a sledgehammer blow of you know, politically friendly. Oh, you know, shouldn't we all hug the trees? Which, you know, I agree with, but it's just sickening to watch it done in such a sort of pandering Hollywood style.
It's very reminiscent of its time, for sure. You know, like,
I had the cure for cancer and I fucking left.
Hey, I will not have you dissing Medicine Man.
Medicine Man is
exactly the same
as next to this.
Yeah, first.
I would have welcomed Robin Williams voicing an animated bat.
No.
In this movie.
No. You go too far, Mr. Forbes.
I like how when Powers Booth is sort of dragged out of the jungle, basically looking like he's just been vomited by a triceratops, one of the National Geographic PG-13 friendly topless ladies just kind of comes over and she's like, you know, you want to fuck around? He's like, oh, no. And she's like, oh, whatever. It's just terrible.
See, I
Charlie get that. Borman climbs a fucking skyscraper?
Yeah,
dude can't find a door? Oh. Even a dog knows how to get in when somebody's buzzing up to another apartment.
It is a ridiculous movie, but I make no apologies. I know.
Because Powers Booth has a gun on the cover, that guarantees it's going to be good.
I honestly make no apologies.
It's Powers Booth going on a, like, vengeance quest through the jungle.
Yes.
And
is that not awesome?
Because that's A, about 0.1% of the movie, and B, the parts that have that are terrible.
I keep forgetting too.
Like how
Meg Foster is in the movie.
Murder tribe, and basically, he was like, he stares at the other guy, and the guy's like, "You have spirit. I will give you a head start." And then turns to the German photojournalist, and everyone sort of like crowds around him, like Night of the Living Dead, and they're just like, "Now we will slowly impale you with sticks."
I love that there's like an evil murder tribe and a German photojournalist.
They're called the Fierce People.
The Fierce People. The Murder Tribe. I like our name better.
We got to come up with a better name for the Invisible People then.
The guys.
People who are painted green.
The Gentle Tribe.
The Gentle.
I like how they're like, oh,
the Navi.
This is the stone that we have used to become the Invisible People, but we only have two stones left. You must go on a spirit quest to find it. And he goes and brings back, like, five more stones. And it's like, either you really shirk your responsibility, or these things last forever. So why are two of these stones such a big deal? And also, how do you take these little pebbles and make an entire tribe invisible for more than, like, 2 hours?
They get them away.
That's a question.
Because they're the Sankara stones, man.
You missed the part with the thuggy cult. Did you watch the extended edition, Andrew?
I saw some really bad soldiers falling off rocks into a river.
Yes, yeah, okay.
It's like they have deadly aim when they're in the forest, but as soon as they get out into the open and Powers Booth is out of ammo, they basically suddenly develop cerebral palsy. Just fall over.
I can't believe you went there.
I bet you Sepultura loved this movie.
Wow. It's not even set in Brazil, John.
Also, John Borman must have something about filming his kids in sex scenes.
Yeah, that's just creepy.
Because he's done it twice. At least Dario Argento is only doing it with one kid.
Yeah, but repeatedly. Over and over and over again.
It is set in Brazil.
Is it set in Brazil?
Yes, so my Sepultura joke stands.
Okay, I'm sorry.
The only way this movie would have gotten worse is if Steve McQueen stumbled in from Papillon doing his terrible French accent. And was just like, am I off the island?
Man, fuck that movie.
Oh, God, I fucking hate that movie. We judge you of a wasted life.
You know what else would have made this movie awesome?
What's that?
And when Powers Booth was stumbling around the jungle, and when he hacked through one of the things, you saw like the guys from Sorcerer with their truck full of explosives.
I also like how the Invisible People are introduced you know, being all invisible, Powers Booth walks into the jungle, and they're basically, like, standing there holding a leaf in front of their face, like,
it's meant to be
totally artistic. Invisible.
It's artistic, man.
Oh, my God. Plus, it's got what's-her-face's freaky eyes.
Meg Foster. And that's the most interesting thing about her. You see her eyes, and, like, 2 seconds later, it's like, okay, get this bitch off camera.
I'm pretty sure when Powers Booth had his crazy spirit animal thing, they just superimposed her eyes over them, over his. All right, I'm done. Steve, what's your ugly?
My ugly?
Do not concentrate on the moon.
You will miss all of the heavenly glory. I probably got to go with Zardoz. I think it has to be Zardoz.
I'm with you on that.
The thing with Zardoz, the problem I have with Zardoz is there's potential there. You know, like there is an idea. There's an idea germinating somewhere in that movie, and it is
germinating in the thong.
Germinating somewhere between the red Speedo and the thigh high go-go boots.
Yeah. Now there is an idea, there is a concept like that could make for really cool sci-fi, but it's executed by someone who has no fucking business doing science fiction. Like the sensibilities, you know, it's like, oh my God, I can't even. It's bad.
Mark Kermode said something. I can't remember who. Someone shared a clip on the – they came from the North Facebook page of Mark Kermode basically saying that it felt like someone who sneered at science fiction.
Yeah, science fiction. Exactly. And that's exactly it. Like it feels derisive of science fiction, you know? Like it feels like someone making a science fiction movie when they have no fucking idea what makes science fiction interesting.
I don't think it's a science fiction movie. I think it's a comedy. I think that's how it plays.
The worst thing about that is it's an unintentional comedy.
I can do better.
Well, yeah.
Bronchitis.
Yeah, but it's its own.
Well, actually, from what I've read, I mean, it was intended to have comic elements in it.
Okay. Yeah.
Like the disembodied floating head of that guy in the beginning that kind of looks like Eric Idle dressed as a nun with like that fake magic. Big magic marker mustache with like a vagina beard, you know, like kind of, you know what I'm talking about? And there's no way you can't tell me that, you know, like the guy who's like, and you poor creatures who were conjured out of clay, who made you, or, you know, that whole thing. I mean, and it's immediately followed by like the most metal logo in movie history, like the word Zardoz, like it was peeled off of like a metal album cover, in your face. And then I think that sets the tone of a movie I'm totally not going to take seriously. It's just a joke. It's just fun.
Okay, well, if it was meant
John
to be...
John Connery looks like the guy who wants to sell you a stereo out of his trunk on Swingers Night.
He looks so great in this movie with this ridiculous ponytail. Holy mackerel. And he's running naked throughout the entire picture, and just the women just can't get enough of him. Cannot get enough Sean Connery. It's like, and apparently he had trouble finding work after James Bond. You know, that's how people kind of saw him. And he goes and does this, like, first, you know, like right out of the gate, you know, like, just, I don't know.
I think Sean Connery had to pay some serious bills.
I don't know if he got paid a lot for this.
I hope not.
I thought you meant he had to pay some serious bills after doing this movie before he could get back into the good graces of moviegoers.
Well, yeah, a little from column A, a little from column B. Sean Connery didn't really get back into the good graces of filmgoers until, what, the 90s? So, you know.
Well, it was until The Hunt for Red October. Well, actually, it was until Untouchables.
Yeah, Untouchables, Hunt for Red October, Medicine Man, you know. But, yeah, no, oh, God, Zardoz. He's terrible in it. I can't think of a single performance in the movie that was redeemable, to be honest with you.
He doesn't say anything in it. He's silent for a lot of the picture.
Yes, but he just looks so unconvincing. He just looks like he's so not into it at all.
How could he not be into it?
I don't know. I really like this movie. I mean, a movie that starts off with like a floating stone head god and like the whole science fiction dystopian fantasy aspect of it that's bonkers. Like, and
you just hate penises. Where,
yeah, exactly. Like, the penis is evil. The penis shoots.
Sonal speaks. The penis. Is evil.
See,
that's my Andre the Giant.
That in and of itself, that explains everything as to why that movie isn't ugly.
The penis shoots seed and creates life.
So, as like the fact that this phrase exists in a film that isn't rated, you know, R for retarded.
I like it. I like the it's, you know, I mean, it's not about what it's about. It's like this kind of, I don't know, what is it about? Class? It's about, you know, what we have exterminators keeping the brutals, this kind of population of Earth in the far future, what past the year, what is it, 2,200 and 22? 2293, that's what
okay.
This movie is any indication of the future. Chest hair is a growth industry.
See, yeah. My thing with it is I lump it into the same category as Logan's Run, in that, you know, you had some cool concepts, some cool ideas, marginally competent execution, but then a production designer and a director who had no fucking idea how to make a science fiction film.
Well, it's because George Lucas hadn't shown him how yet.
Exactly. Like, well, George Lucas and Kubrick, you know? Yeah.
Well, I mean, in
this
that
came way, after Kubrick.
I know it did, but obviously he hadn't seen 2001 at that point.
No, if it's not 2001, it's Clockwork Orange. You know that if he's drawing inspiration from anything from Zardoz, it's that.
Okay,
you know,
okay, yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
I mean, you got there's a lot of sexual imagery. You know, there's like interesting future technology, holograms. You know, a future language that has evolved into this. From the spelling of like 9-year-olds texting each other, you know, like everything ends with a Z, like needs, cats,
I think
carrots
Borman,
with a K.
I think when Borman sat down and watched Clockwork Orange, he was on a lot of that funky, what was it, Ultra Milk? Whatever fucking.
Well, it's further, way further out there than a Clockwork Orange in a certain way. I mean, because you're using like the externals, they exhibit mental telepathy and psychic powers, and they're obsessed with Sean Connery's cock, you know, which is like,
aren't we all?
Especially at Charlotte Rampling, who that hot number who plays Consuela, you know,
you just like it because of Connery.
She totally gives Sean Connery huge boners in this movie, and. That is a one-to-one translation of what you see on screen and what I just said. That is, he literally stares at her and gets a boner. That's the scene.
We need to stop talking about Zardoz.
But let's keep talking about Sean Connery.
Got to keep going because, you know, if you have a movie where Sean Connery is walking around and all of the women in the movie are getting their titties out, you know, and not kidding. This isn't a joke. This is like the movie, and like every single time, you know. I mean,
I rest my case.
It gets into some interesting territory because you have these apathetics, right? You know, this class of these Eternals who live in the vortex and all this kind of crazy. Which a vortex is basically this Irish estate, you know, that's behind a force field and. You know, you have these people who are relatively indifferent to their lives and existing and don't do or say anything because these Eternals, they live forever and they're able to, you know, like regenerate and they don't die and they don't grow old. Well, they do grow old if they're punished for a crime against their society.
I feel like I'm going insane.
it's interesting what it's trying to say, you know, like it's saying...
I'm not trying to take away from what you're saying. It's just... incredibly crazy.
There's an unwritten rule. I call it the Steve rule. And this came from my days working the video store. You can define the quality of a TV series or a movie by how absolutely batshit insane somebody sounds when they read a plot synopsis.
Yeah. It's like you would sound as crazy as describing a TV show like The Prisoners or The Prisoner as you would describing Zardoz.
That's actually kind of a good – there is something to be said about, you know, The Prisoners and this strange kind of – 60s and 70s peculiarly British view of science fiction.
Yeah,
which was manifest also in that era's Doctor Who.
Yeah, and even A Clockwork Orange, man, you know, like it has that very, very British science fiction tone to it, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're willing to sort of embrace absurdity.
And maybe
in
a lot of, I think,
American filmmakers were a little more hesitant.
Maybe our issue is we are the Star Wars generation. You know, we are all born after 1977, as far as I know. So, you know, it's kind of – maybe that's
– I mean, the difference between a movie like Star Wars and a movie like Zardoz is Star Wars is, the hero monomyth and this adventure. And Zardoz is, like, playing around with ideas like, you know, what happens if you give man infinite life and that, you know, they – you know, their understanding of the cosmos becomes stunted over time. And you know, what is the true punishment, you know, like to be put to death or to be doomed to, like, you know, be forever senile, you know, and trapped in that sort of state. And, you know, would you welcome death eventually and the inevitability or the necessity of it? And
I'm finding myself willing to.
Yeah, like
just, I'm just
these petty questions.
Like,
Star Wars is like blow up the thing, you know. Blow up the thing.
I would love if that was what that's the entire mission briefing was in Star Wars.
That's the thing right there. Blow it up. Blow up the thing.
And that's what is the third one? The third one is blow up the thing again. Blow it up. You know, I mean, at least Zardoz has like, you know, Don Connery impregnating everything,
but we're sad.
You know, at least Zardoz has Sean Connery in a wedding dress. You know, I mean,
man,
you're not
what fucking movie did you watch? That was not the movie that I saw.
You know, Sean Connery is in a wedding dress in this movie.
Yes. And that's another sure sign of quality right there. If a dude dresses in drag.
Clearly, I think the difference here is that Steve would not use the phrase, at least this movie has Sean Connery.
That is me. The right admission to see Sean Connery shoot me in the face within the first minute of the movie at that handlebar mustache and just... You know,
to be my bride.
I should have made this good. I'm sorry. Long live Zardoz.
Did McVeigh. Okay, whose ugly was that?
That was mine.
Sorry.
John?
I think John.
Yes,
John's dead.
I took off my headset.
Oh, okay. You shouldn't have. You missed a lot of great stuff.
All right. My ugly Exorcist 2.
That's a good choice.
Yeah. Is there a horror franchise?
There's no other context where someone could say Exorcist 2. That's a good choice.
Yeah. Well, seriously, guys, is there a horror franchise more inexplicable than The Exorcist? The only movie in the series to make money since the original came out was the 2000 theatrical re-release of the original.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
I did like the third one, and I did like the Paul Schrader one. I'm not going to lie.
The third one has that crazy jump scare.
Yeah.
Oh, scissors.
I like the George C. Scott and Jason Miller performances in the third. But...
The Exorcist 2, the biggest problem with The Exorcist 2 is just how fucking boring it is.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, when the best credit you can give a director of a sequel is that, well, at least he didn't try to rehash the original, you might have a fucking problem.
Yeah.
Exorcist 2 is a hot mess. And The synchronizer. Fuck that. A pair of electrodes hooked on one end to a headband, the other end to a panini grill, and a pair of strobe lights. And that's fucking Pazazu's gateway back. Doesn't the synchronizer lead into
I love that you call Pazuzu Pazazu. It makes him sound way classy.
Like, Pazazu. Pazazu is fabulous.
I'm sorry, it's Pazuzu? That makes him sound like he's a character on fucking Pokio.
I think he came from the Emerald Forest myself. Yeah.
Pazazu sounds like he's a sequined demon.
You know, Pazazu, he designed all of Randy Savage's capes.
He haunts Liberace's chandeliers. Ooh.
And didn't the synchronizer lead to the fucking tap dancing?
I forgot about that.
And also, Linda Blair is a terrible actress.
She is. She really is.
Yes.
Yeah, without the whole, you know, William Friedkin terrifying her into a decent performance.
It's because Friedkin was batshit insane.
Friedkin was on a lot of drugs when they made The Exorcist.
He's still on a lot of drugs, isn't he?
No,
when the most likable person in your movie is Louise Fletcher,
we have
serious problems.
Foreman, we got to talk.
Get off the sauce, John. Get it off the sauce.
Oh, God.
Yeah, no, but Exorcist 2 is just, it's really, really, really cripplingly boring.
It is an extremely boring movie. And then when, you know, you get into stuff. I forgot about the sequenizer or sequencer, whatever the fuck it was called.
The sequenizer.
Pazazu sequenizer, yeah, for making things fabulous. I forgot about that shit. Like, when the movie does start to kind of come together, it's just so ridiculously silly.
Yeah.
And another point that Mark Kermode made in the same video where he was talking about Zardoz was that this movie had a lot of money to play with.
Yeah.
And it looks like shit.
Yep.
When you compare it to the set pieces, I mean, limited though they were in the original Exorcist, and then look at this, it looks like, I mean, it's, and you basically have like a rubber dummy taking the place of Linda Blair in makeup at the end of the movie. It's like the Halloween mask version of Regan McNeil.
Oh.
But I would say this is by far although I really wanted to rip on Emerald Forest, this is the best performance made because it's got so little life in it. It's like the ultimate, like, the weird thing is, I mean, it feels like a lazy sequel, even though it's trying to do a whole bunch of different things. It still feels incredibly lazy.
Yeah, and I think, too, like, what's even doubly tragic about that was I think they consciously set out to do something really different, you know? They consciously set out to not just remake the original, you know?
Because John Borman didn't just want to make a horror movie, you know, heaven forbid.
I think, yeah, and like knowing what I know about Borman and seeing the movies that Borman made before The Exorcist 2, he was a piss poor choice as a director for that movie. Yeah. Like, I mean, when
if it took place in the woods, maybe.
Yeah. If they all went, you know, on a canoeing trip.
But yeah, I mean, anything having to do with supernatural terror, he's
not the first name that comes to mind,
which is actually odd because I mean there's some fairly nightmarish imagery in Excalibur, but it's such a it's a dream pace versus what should be a tense atmosphere, sort of scaring pace.
Yeah.
And it's just, oh, and I forgot that they dragged Ned Beatty into it.
I forgot about that too. Yeah. I think the less we talk about The Exorcist 2, the better. I think we all just agree that that's as ugly.
It is indeed. McVeigh, what's your ugly? Because I'm pretty sure it wasn't Zardoz.
uh,
I'm not going to put you guys through that again. I'm sorry. I'm gonna just say Zardoz and let's call it.
No, you did a fan-fucking-tastic job of no, defending man. Zardoz. Yeah. Grow a goddamn spine, will you?
No. I mean, there's only so much I could talk about Sean Connery's erections. So.
Zardoz, man, you love Zardoz, and I don't want to take that away from you.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's very entertaining. It's definitely an oddity, and it's it is what it is.
Again, I differ from someone. I do want to take the Emerald Forest away from Steve.
You know, still remember Black Rain, Forbes.
Michael Douglas.
Curse you, Michael Douglas.
All right, well, in that case, Mike, if you don't want to...
I defer. I think Zardoz will do it for me, guys.
Okay.
save our listeners.
It's a good and an ugly. Yeah,
save our listeners another rant.
It is a good, a bad, and an ugly.
All right, so final thoughts on John Borman. Steve?
I think Borman is... Of, like, the more obscure guys we've picked, you know, like, when we've gone for these real... You know, out of left field choices that are still somewhat contemporary and not more like classics as directors. Borman surprised me the most. Borman, for whatever reason, man, like, I don't know if it was because of the damage done to him by The Exorcist 2 and Zardoz, but that dude does not get anywhere near enough credit. You know, like, this guy should have the same kind of cult following as some of these other, like, you know, guys like Walter Hill or guys like John Milius and you know, Terrence Malick. And, like, these guys all have their – they're not quite, you know, Hollywood royalty, but they've got their cult following. And Borman really should have one. Borman should really have a cult that follows him around, you know. He deserves it, I think, for the most part. Like, I mean, I'd say, what, 96, 97% of his body of work is infinitely watchable. You know, he's got a great collection of stuff out there. He's got maybe, you know, of a pretty prolific career, he's got maybe three or four real, like, out-and-out, what I would class as duds. And that's a pretty goddamn good ratio by anybody's standards. You know, like, no, he's not Steven Spielberg. He's not, you know, the Wayne Gretzky of filmmaking or anything. But at the same time, he's an interesting cat. He's a beautiful visualist. And, like, there's not really anybody else out there that can be considered a straight-up comparison to him. You know, like, he does things... Mm. He really does things his own way.
He is distinctive.
He is
very distinctive. Yeah, I mean, for me, he's the kind of filmmaker... He's obviously a born image maker.
Yeah.
He's got an amazing eye. There are shots and scenes from his movies that will never leave my mind, for sure. I do sort of wish... I feel like maybe he got a bit bloated and a bit self-important later in his career, and I kind of wish he could go back to the sort of leaner, hungrier, point-blank Borman. Although I guess with maybe with things like The General, he kind of headed back in that direction. But yeah, he's good.
I think you know, like, I look at guys a lot. Like, I look at I'm a big fan of a lot of the guys who got their start, you know, in the gritty 70s, guys like Walter Hill and guys like John Milius. And a lot of these guys, they got a very signature style. Like, I mean, they got little subtle differences that set them apart. But at the same time, you know, they all kind of come from that same school. Whereas Borman really is, you know, he is a distinct cat. He does really have his own taste. Like, he's his own taste, you know? And I think he deserves better than what he's gotten.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Mike? Final thoughts?
If you had to, going back on what Steve said, if you had to name the cult of John Borman followers, what would it be? I was thinking maybe the thigh highs or something.
The go-go boots.
Yeah. What would his cult following be called?
The Borman brides.
Just the boars.
The boar warriors.
Oh.
The Boriers.
You're starting to think too much like me, Forbes. It's starting to scare me. I don't know which of us is... I don't know if I'm getting more intellectually superior or you're slipping.
I don't know how I feel about this.
Forbes.
John, how about you?
Yes.
Yes, I have some.
I always hate when this comes back to me because everyone else has intelligent stuff, and I'm always like, duh, go back and watch Point Blank.
Actually, that's probably the most intelligent thing that we've said. So let's wrap up with that.
Fuck that. Excalibur, bitches.
Excalibur.
Yeah. Do we know who we're doing next?
Yes, we do.
Against Joe.
Against Joe.
I never saw this.
I never saw this. A nightmare to others.
Effect budget run out.
Up next, we've got another John, actually. We will be tackling the stylings of, you know, Pinko Nut Job, or not even Pink. I don't know what you'd call them.
Zen fascist.
Esteemed Hollywood screenplay writer at one point in his life, action movie filmmaker, and the man who triumphantly created, I think, the career of Arnold Schwarzenegger with Conan the Barbarian. We'll be talking about John Milius.
The anti-Pinko.
The anti-Pinko, yeah. So until next time, you know, when you can have our podcast when you pry it from our cold, dead hands.
See you on a Wednesday.